Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. This week, we'll be talking about raising a visually impaired child from the perspective of the parents.
You've met Rebecca several times in the past. This week, we'll speak with her parents, Steve and Marjorie, about their experiences raising her, navigating the school system and the rest of the world, and teaching her to be an independent young adult. Towards the end of the program, we will also share some useful resources for parents of blind children and let you know how you can get Rebecca's perspective. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip is, if you're raising a blind or visually impaired child, you're not alone. Other people have navigated this path before you, and there are resources available to help you on this path, and lots of people willing to share their experiences, and that can be helpful too.
It's important to know what resources and services are available for you and your child, and also to network with other people. That can be very important, as she says.
Let's start by meeting Marjorie and Steve and learning about Rebecca's eye condition.
I'm Marjorie.
And I'm Steve.
And you have a blind child, right?
Yes.
And we've interviewed her several times on this show, and she is quite a remarkable person. So we thought we'd take an opportunity to get to know the parents. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about yourselves. What do each of you do these days?
I'm a middle school teacher. I teach sixth grade math and science.
I'm a manufacturer's representative, which means I don't manufacture anything. I represent a bunch of manufacturers. And previous to that, I was an engineer.
So anyways, you're probably quite excited when she was born. What was your first inkling that there might be some issues?
Rebecca's eyes from birth on, they were not straight. They were floating all over the place. I took her to the pediatrician with concerns, and they told me that I needed to wait because sometimes it just straightens itself out, but it didn't straighten itself out. And then I had made an appointment to see a specialist, and her first appointment was at 5 months old.
So this issue was caught pretty early. Was it easy to diagnose?
No, she wasn't diagnosed until she was about 6 years old with exactly what she has now.
What is the official diagnosis?
She has congenital stationary night blindness.
Can you explain what that means?
It's a congenital defect, and basically her vision should not get any worse. Some people, it just affects their night vision, but for Rebecca, it affects her night vision. It also affects, she has contrast issues, and she's also visually impaired, so she needs large print.
What were some of the issues there? Why was that such a difficult diagnosis?
Well, up until about age 5, the doctor just felt that she basically just needed glasses. They had no way of knowing that she could not see in the dark. She was afraid of the dark as a child, but those were just normal childhood fears. We were not alerted to that. She could never verbalize to us that she couldn't see. And the doctor felt her vision at around age 5 should have been a lot better than it was. And then he referred us to a doctor to have a test called an ERG done at Mount Sinai. And by doing that test, that's how they picked it up.
There were some hints that this was going on, but, you know, no one ever put two and two together because the condition was so rare. You know, we were at Disney and we took her to an attraction where everything was very low light. And we asked her if she saw certain things and she said no. And again, we just attributed it to resolution issues and not necessarily to the condition that she had. But, you know, once she got to the point where they started, you know, doing some more extensive tests, including light level related tests, I think at that point, that's when things became a little bit clearer.
Well, it's interesting, of course, you know, young kids just don't have mechanisms for feeding back to adults what their issues might be. And so you have to rely on some kind of physical analysis.
What did the doctors try to do for her at a very early age?
She had eye surgeries for muscle issues. Her eyes weren't straight, so they had to do two surgeries. She was patched pretty much all day long for about a year to get, you know, to strengthen her eyes. They told us that she would have lost vision in one of her eyes if we did not do that. You know, we did everything that we had to do as parents to, you know, make sure that she had the best vision possible. But again, it was around age five where they felt that something wasn't right.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is what it's been like for Steve and Marjorie to raise a blind child.
So how did your concerns develop over time as you were parents? I mean, this could be quite a trauma for parents sometimes to, you know, deal with something so different.
Well, the first time I went to the pediatric ophthalmologist, I walked out of that office with a list of things that I was just so overwhelmed of what was wrong with my daughter's vision. I was just so overwhelmed at that moment and being, you know, a first-time parent and having no experience with anything, I was quite overwhelmed. It was a lot for me to handle, being told that my daughter could lose her vision, that she couldn't see as a baby. I had to put her in glasses as an infant. Those were very hard things to deal with. I was also told in the office where they patched her eye and she took the patch off, the doctor told me that if she wasn't able to keep the patch on, that they would have to tie her hands down to boards because she would lose her vision otherwise.
Oh, that can be a trauma for parents to see. I remember my mom talking about experiences like that when I was an infant and in the hospital with eye surgery.
So basically what I did was I stayed home for many days with her and I worked with her and I distracted her until we got her to wear the patch. And she was not only wearing the patch, but she was also wearing glasses at that time. So both of them were difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and especially since, like you said, you were both working at the time, it was, you know, fortunate that you were able to take that time away from work and be with her.
Yes, yes.
So how much help was the pediatric ophthalmologist at the time? Sometimes I get the impression that doctors will diagnose the problem and say, here's the issue. But in terms of how to deal with this in real life and how it affects your life and living style, they're not quite so helpful.
He was of no help. After he sent us to Manhattan to see this doctor who did this ERG, that was a pretty traumatic experience for Rebecca at that age and myself. And it was a horrible test. The guy had no bedside manner. She was screaming, I want to leave. It was pretty a day I'll never forget. But we got through it. And he came out and told me that she had congenital stationary night blindness. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, she can't see in the dark. And that was basically it.
And then they let you go.
And he let me go. And we brought that diagnosis back to, and all I can think of was, well, she probably won't be able to drive. Okay, that's not horrible. And we went back to the regular ophthalmologist. And he basically really wasn't familiar with the condition at all. He had no experience. He never had a patient with it.
Now, fortunately, you people are pretty intelligent and proactive people, and I know from listening to Rebecca that you've been very supportive, finding resources. Where did you turn at this time to find resources and help with this issue?
At first, I was on the internet just, you know, reading as much as I could, and at that time, there wasn't a lot out there on her condition because it was recently only discovered. Only very few people, a small amount of people in the entire world have exactly that condition. Because I'm in education, I know a lot about educational law. And where she went to school, they had never dealt with anything like this before. So we were really groundbreaking in that school. You know, I learned that, you know, her environment needed to be adjusted. And my biggest concern as a parent was her safety.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the school with many, many concerns about lighting, things like that. And when the school gave me a hard time, we really had a hard time. I was told that we're not changing our electrical system for your daughter. And the stupid comments like that, really ignorant things were said. And of course, everything was changed.
You mean eventually the school did change some of these things as time progressed and they became more accommodating to the issue?
Yes, the school did. Yes, I was a very persistent, but I was also a very knowledgeable parent. And I went in with what was best for her. I didn't ask what she needed. I basically told them what she needed.
Where did you finally find useful help?
My mom also started doing some research, and she came across the New York State Commission for the Blind, and Arnie Chapman really changed our life.
And what kind of help did they provide?
One of the best programs they had was the Helen Keller Saturday program. And through that, she was able to meet other children with visual impairments and who were blind. And that was an incredible program. She met so many other kids. People who worked there were amazing. And I got to meet other parents, and we got to sit down as a group and talk about things that were similar in our homes.
This must have been a welcome support network for you, because you had been kind of solo up until this point.
Yes. And most people have been. I never really came across anybody who had a child with that disability. And it was a great resource for us. And it ran many years. She went scuba diving. There were amazing programs. They took them all over. They just really enabled them and showed them they could do things where they modified things. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist today, because I went back to ask to volunteer and they told me that it was cut due to funding.
Oh,
interesting. That's too bad. So they had all these great experiences for the kids. What kind of programs did they have for the parents?
One of the best things that happened in one of the Helen Keller Saturday courses that I experienced was they had the parents wear different types of glasses. So we were able to experience what it was like to be visually impaired and to do everyday tasks. And that was a real eye-opener, how to write a check, how to pour into a glass. And if those programs don't exist, you know, try to create them with other people. And that's really, that was so helpful and so supportive to me.
So at what age did she start using a white cane?
Probably she was in middle school, probably about sixth grade.
And that would have corresponded with when she started needing to change rooms to attend different subject matter classes?
Yes, yes. I was very proactive. I called the school before she was going to middle school for the transition. And I told them that they had a visually impaired student coming in next year. And they were like, really? They didn't know. And basically, I asked for a tour of the building. And then we brought mobility people in as well. And we all toured the building. And the mobility specialist went through what things would need to be changed to make the building safe for her. So they actually had to put tape on the steps so she could see navigating up and down the stairs. It was some coordination with the locker. She and I were afraid, how was she going to handle the opening the combination locker? So there are large print lockers. So we actually went in before she went into middle school, and her locker was picked for location, and we practiced. And we had an orientation and mobility specialist meet her in the middle school before school started. You know, they did the classes, they did the steps, and that was probably more than once. So she was able to go on the first day and feel comfortable. A lot of pre-things were done to make those first time.
Good planning makes a big difference.
We actually met up with her at her high school once, and she gave us a tour, and she showed us the tape on the stairs and the locker at the end of the row so she could find it. And so I gather going from middle school through high school, they were able to do the same things.
Same thing was done. I went on those days. Also, when they walk in through the doors, there's metal supports, and they had to put reflectors on them because she wouldn't be able to see it.
Those can hurt when you walk into them.
Yes. So, you know, things that I, as a parent, saw, and, you know, again, as, you know, someone who was trained between, it was a team. You have to be a team. Everyone has to work together. And that the high school was great. The middle school was great. Once everyone understood that we were a team and we were there to support her, to make it a safe place for everybody, it really went much better.
So although you had some initial difficulties in negotiating these issues with the school, it sounds like after a while, they kind of learned and everybody kind of learned and learned to work better together to make these accommodations.
Yes, yes, absolutely, yes. There's always stuff that comes up that you just have to deal with on, you know, things you can't always predict.
Right.
And you just deal with it.
So now she's at a university. Have they been making accommodations like that for her, or just providing her with whatever written materials she needs in a format that she can deal with?
I wish I could say it was perfect, but the world isn't perfect. she's a very good advocate for herself. So right before her classes start, she contacts every professor and, you know, she introduces herself through email and she tells them that she's visually impaired and she needs large print and things like that. And she basically tells them that she's there to help them, you know, whatever they need, and the school's there. And she has found, and I guess I approached it the same way, is letting people know before.
Yeah, I found that also in going through school, you know, planning ahead of time, knowing what your books are going to be, talking to the professors ahead of time, as much as you can plan ahead of time, that's really helpful. And offering people solutions instead of problems, because who knows what you need yourself better than you.
Right. It's working for her. There are still things that come up, but that's life. There are always going to be things that come up. So
we all have challenges, sighted or not, right?
Right. So, and you just can't plan for everything and you take it as it comes.
So now that she's learned all these skills, and as you say, she's pretty proactive, she's incredibly successful going through college and her research, what concerns do you still have as parents?
Safety issues, that she's going to get hurt, she's going to fall, you know, she's not going to see something. She doesn't have a guide dog as of yet. It's something that she can have, but, you know, she's a teenager in college.
Well, I think all parents start to worry when their kids go to college because there's so much out of sight.
She actually travels all over the place, going to conferences, going to visit people. She's in school in one city, spending the summer in another city, grew up in another city. What have you guys had to do in order to facilitate any of that? Or is she just so capable that she's doing that all on her own?
Pay for it.
Yeah, there is that.
Not all of it. She's actually managed to get a good amount of it covered, but to make sure that she does have backup transportation. And but some of this is nothing that, you know, you wouldn't have to do even if you had a, you know, sighted child and, you know, in college. We just have to trust, you know, and, you know, continue to give her good advice. From my perspective, this is the natural progression of things. And, you know, we're happy that, you know, everything that we've done, you know, and put in place has kept her positive and motivated to the point where she is more independent and can do more things on her own. We hope that she can continue to do things independently, you know, and there won't be any limits. But eventually, you know, reality does set in. Like Marjorie mentioned, you know, there have been a couple of professors who, because of her specific disability, she doesn't appear to have a vision issue. And some of the professors actually don't believe it. And for her, it's very frustrating. But from my perspective, I believe that it's also another lesson for her, because in the end, when she, you know, does enter the working world, she's not going to be able to continue to just say to customers and prospective clients, you know, you need to accommodate me. At that point, you know, she's going to have to find a way to just make it part and parcel of the way she goes, you know, about things, and it won't be an issue. I think slowly but surely, as she blends into the working world with all this research and travel, I think she's learning those, you know, valuable life lessons. And so that, I believe that that means that she will be ready when she does finally make the transition over to wherever she'll come to rest.
Well, and I think you're right. As people go on in life, whether they have some physical challenge or not, these kinds of skills that she's learning because she had to learn them are going to serve her well in all aspects of her professional and personal career.
And the best thing a parent can do for a child is help instill all of those skills and the confidence to use them so that the child can go off and be an independent person.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to talk a little bit about was the struggle as a parent in making the trade-off between raising your child to be independent versus it's often a parent's natural tendency to be very protective and sometimes overprotective. I've seen some blind children raised where their parents were very overprotective, and by the time they were 20, they couldn't feed themselves, couldn't tell time. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about the struggle of letting her do things on her own versus doing things for her and how you approach that.
I don't think that was actually an issue for us, because from early on when we taught her how to advocate, I think that took a pretty high priority in her personality, to the point when we would try to do things for her, you know, when we sensed that there might be a limitation, she would actually fight it. And you know, I think we quickly learned, you know, to pick our battles in those cases and not be overly protective. You know, sometimes where we have our concerns that she's so sure-footed that she may forget her own, you know, limitations. But eventually, you can't protect your kid forever. You know, you have to let them out of the nest and let them, you know, make a few mistakes. You know, if you can be around when they make the mistakes to catch them, great. But, you know, standing in front of them, you know, with a net, I don't think that's a healthy thing. And I don't think either of us took that approach, you know, to raising her.
So. No, we try to walk beside her and guide her, but not do things for her, to show her the way. But again, there was nothing that was ever off limits about what she could do.
So you also have a sighted child who's a few years younger than Rebecca. How did you navigate the interactions between the two of them and maybe the extra attention that Rebecca needed to get because of all of the medical visits and going into the schools and advocating there?
We did the best we could. You know, it's very difficult when one child has a disability in a family and the other one doesn't. I don't know what to say. It wasn't easy. It's something that's always in the back of your mind, but we're family. We do things together. We support each other. Things that Rebecca couldn't do, or things that Rebecca got to do, you know, because of her disability, that maybe was seemed a little bit specialer at the time, then we tried to make that time or do something special with our other daughter.
As much as you try to balance it, I don't think you can ever effectively balance things at the time. It's always going to be a little lopsided because of the fact that, you know, the child with the disability needs, whether it is actually more attention or just appears to be more attention, there's always going to be that imbalance in perception. And like Marjorie said, all we could do was just to try to make it as equally balanced in terms of time, you know, special time and just different things to try to offset things as possible.
We've been talking a lot about academics. Were there any social issues you ran into on account of Rebecca's visual problems?
Socially was hard. She was good at academics. Socially was another issue. That's why especially the Saturday program was amazing, because she had friends. She fit in. It was hard for her. There was bullying at school because of her vision. We had a few incidences. They were unfortunate. But even people without disabilities get bullied as well.
I think it's a little bit hard to distinguish how much of the social issues were just the fact that in certain areas, she's operating on a more of a technical...
Well, kind of an advanced academic level.
Once, you know, that became apparent and she started, you know, floating in the circles with the technical competitions, and then in college, she found her peers. And I think she adjusted more socially.
Rebecca seems to be succeeding quite well. What do you attribute that to?
There was an amazing team, and Rebecca's successful and got through, you know, graduated high school and is where she is today is because of the people on that team, from the principal, the assistant principal, the vision teacher, numerous teachers, all played a huge role.
And she's told us how huge of a role the two of you played, and she is eternally grateful for that and understands that your advocacy on her behalf really made a huge difference.
Right. But again, it does take a village. It takes a lot of people. You know, she was a key player in it as well.
But most of the programs that we've had to participate in, a big part of it is teaching her how to advocate for herself. That's been a big theme that we've, you know, made sure is that she knows how to ask for the right type of assistance at times when she needs it.
Well, and I think that's such a big thing. I mean, you did that very well for her when she was young because, you know, young people just can't advocate for themselves, but you taught her those skills and they've served her very well. Well, you guys should be very proud.
We are.
Thank you.
And we would like to thank both Steve and Marjorie for being so open about what can be a very emotional and personal journey that they've taken with Rebecca. And, I mean, we've gotten to know Rebecca over the last 4 years, and she's a wonderful young woman, and Steve and Marjorie deserve a lot of the credit for that. And we hope that it's helpful to parents of other children with visual impairments. Now for this week's final item, some useful resources for parents of children with visual impairments and how you can get Rebecca's perspective on many of the things that we've been talking about with her parents.
Well, let's start with one good suggestion. There are a lot of resources at Eyes on Success. You can do searches in our search field on our website to look for shows with Rebecca, look for shows about science, parenting, and education, as well as a number of other topics. That will bring up a list of shows matching those search terms with the links to the audio for that episode, as well as the show notes and a summary. My second suggestion is, if you don't want to listen to the whole show and just find the resources, you can click on the link to the show notes, and that's where we keep all the resources, contact information, telephone numbers, so that's an easy place to find these things. But also, there are a number of other resources on the net. You should find out where your local agency for the blind is, and how to get in touch with them. That can be very helpful.
And then on a national level, and we will have these resources in the show notes for this show, there's the National Association for Parents of Children with Visual Impairments, which refers to themselves as NAPV, and AFB, the American Foundation for the Blind, runs Family Connect, which also has a plethora of good resources for parents of children with visual impairments.
So that'll get you started. And if you need more information, you can always write a note to us.
Now, if you'd like to hear Rebecca's perspective on some of the topics that we've talked about with her parents today, the first show she was on was one of our very earliest episodes. And we were talking about education in general, and in particular, how she managed to get through high school with a visual impairment. That was show 1112. 1143, we spoke with her about what was important in selecting and applying to college and taking those all-important standardized tests with a visual impairment. And then 1249, by then she was in college, and we talked to her about the transition to college life. And also in 1123, we spoke with her about some of the technical competitions that she participated and excelled in, including the International Science and Engineering Fair, in which she took a top prize. And then more recently at her university, they had a series of TED Talks, and Rebecca, as a freshman, was selected from among thousands of undergraduates to give one of those presentations, and we will have a link to that YouTube video.
So just go to our show notes at www.eyesonsuccess.net for all of that, and be sure to use our search function. It can be very helpful.
That's it for show number 1440. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about the Victor Reader Stream. We'll speak with Matthew Janisauskas, product manager at Humanware for the Victor Reader family of accessible media players, about some of the new and exciting features in the recently released firmware update for the Victor Reader Stream that are enabled by the built-in Wi-Fi capability. And we will also speak about the Victor Reader Stratus desktop version. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and on audioboo.fm at Eyes on Success, or Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.